I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Keith McHenry. His new book is called Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food, Not Bombs. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me again, Mary Charlotte. It's so cool.
So we just talked to you a few days ago in advance of your book signing at the Taos Public Library, but I wanted to give you more time because this is a book, it's kind of a historical book about food, not bombs. It's a handbook for people who want to do community organizing and feed the hungry and things like that. And it's also kind of prescient in ways that we will see regarding the Occupy movement. But let's go back into history just for a moment. Food Not Bombs, you've been doing it for, what, 3 decades?
Yeah, 31 years. We kind of marked May 24th occupation attempt of Seabrook Nuclear Power Station as the beginning of Food Not Bombs, where one of our co-founders was arrested. And as a result of his arrest, he was a law student at Boston University. We decided to hold bake sales and to raise money, and it was not very effective. But fortunately, we came across a poster that it was being discarded that many people, listeners will know of, which said that wouldn't it be a beautiful day if the schools had all the money they needed and the Air Force had to buy a hold a bake sale to buy a bomber. We dressed up as military people and went out, sold our baked goods, and tried to cajole people into stopping because of our sign saying that we were trying to buy a bomber.
Oh, that's very funny. So that was the beginning of Food Not Bombs. But one of the things that is very interesting in the way that you evolved, I mean, there's a lot of things that are very interesting, is that you were working at a store that sold healthy foods, Whole Foods. It wasn't Whole Foods. It was Bread and Circus.
Bread and Circus, correct.
In Massachusetts, in the Boston area. And there was a lot of food there that was discarded, and you collected that food and then eventually from other places as well and started to distribute it to people who were hungry.
Correct, yeah. In those days, there was all these very hungry people at housing projects not far from where this natural food store was. And up until that point, I was hired to be the produce manager because I did produce at the Boston Food Co-op. So natural food, organic food, had been kind of limited to the food co-op movement, and this was an early attempt at starting a commercial natural food store.
Right.
So I would get 5 or 6 boxes, sometimes 7 cases of really great produce that I had to discard, and I started delivering it to these housing projects.
What was wrong with it?
Well, it would be wilted. You knew that people would get it home to their refrigerator, and it would be droopy because it was natural. And then they would be dismayed that their lettuce wasn't looking fresh 2 days later. And people were buying, in those days, iceberg lettuce. So this was, red leaf and delicate foods.
Yeah.
And then maybe the apples weren't exactly perfectly the right shape, or they'd have worms in them. Or there'd be who knows what kind of blemishes that made it look less than perfect.
So essentially cosmetic blemishes and the reality that unprocessed food is imperfect.
Correct, yes. And at that time, there was a lot more concern that the public would not shop there and they'd move on to, Stop and Shop or something because they didn't understand the nature of organic produce and what the real value was, because also we're charging more money, so it had to look more perfect. And so the miraculous thing that I discovered is that not only did I end up with all this food, but that I discovered all these really hungry people that were in my community. And across the street from the projects that I was taking the food to were these huge new modern glass buildings. And it turned out that they were called Draper Lab. And it was a laboratory where MIT scientists had started a venture capitalist startup company to design the guidance system for intercontinental nuclear missiles. And this is when Reagan is starting to talk about Star Wars and all these things like that. And I would see this disparity between these very poor people on one side of the street and this amazing amount of opulence on the other side. And it was all for the purpose of making bombs hit their target in the Soviet Union. It was pretty outrageous.
So the movement then expanded to being not only a redistribution of food, but basically community meals in which people really got talking to each other about the realities of their lives.
Yeah, we delivered the food to housing projects. The very first action, actually, that we call that's like what we know of as Who Not Bombs now, was we had discovered that the board of directors of the Bank of Boston were also on the board of directors of the Public Service Company of New Hampshire that was building Seabrook Nuclear Power Station, and they were in the board of Babcock and Wilcox, Raytheon Missile Systems. The same small number of wealthy men were on the boards of all these interlocking companies. So we made a brochure. I was approached to make a brochure about this, and we started organizing protests against the Bank of Boston. We determined that there was going to be a stockholders meeting on March 26, 1981, at the Federal Reserve Bank at South Station. So we decided that we'd go down there and dress up as hobos, make this huge amount of soup from the food we were recovering, and then stand in front of the bank at lunchtime and hand out the soup and saying, look, your policies could lead to economic collapse where Americans will be finding themselves standing in line to eat soup. And we became concerned we'd have all this food, but it would go to waste because we didn't have enough people. So I went to the Pine Street Inn in the South End.
Yeah, I remember that. I used to live in Boston, yeah. Right.
And in those days, it was one of the few housing, shelters for men. It was mostly Vietnam, Korean War, World War II vets. I gave a speech about the need to protest the Bank of Boston. The next day, about 70 people showed up. And what became this idea of the hungry that came to eat but hanging out and talking to business people was born on that day, because it became the business people had never seen like a soup line since the Great Depression. So to them that was a shock. It was not to be expected. So they were more than eager to hang out and spend some time with the homeless people that were eating there, and the magic of that community conversation that was happening amongst diverse economic backgrounds was so magical that we decided that night when we were washing our pots and pans that we'd quit our jobs and do nothing but collect food, deliver it to people that needed it, and then set up these community meals every afternoon and evening for, to us, being 23 years old, I thought I'd be doing that, for... I had no idea what the future would hold, but
right.
To me, I was just going to keep doing
years.
It. Yeah, right.
So there's something that I always wonder about. I mean, it's important not to judge people you don't know and whose stories you don't know. And there's that saying that an enemy is a person whose story you haven't heard yet and that right. kind of thing. And then you have this tremendous disparity of wealth and poverty in this country, which is structural. I mean, as you point out in your book, there's so many people who have kind of bought this line about how it's all about personal responsibility. But when you look at the big picture in a systemic way, it has to do with tax policy and much bigger issues that create this disparity of wealth. And from one country to another, you have huge differences in whether or not there's a disparity of wealth. So you have these conversations. Do they do any good?
Well, what is fascinating is, I think in a sense, we could, I know there's several direct events. One, which I spoke about last week, was the case in Iceland, where people at first thought it was crazy that we were sharing food, because after all, Iceland was a wealthy, first world country.
Give us background, because maybe some people didn't hear our very short segment last week.
Yeah, so I ended up traveling to Iceland on a way actually to a food waste conference in Northampton, England, at a University of Northampton. And I stayed there for a week. And the Food Not Bombs chapter, turned out it was at the time that the economy was collapsing. And when I got there, they shared with me in Reykjavik that the Food Not Bombs chapter had served food for over a year, maybe a year and a half, every Saturday at this plaza downtown. And most people thought it was crazy that there was free food because, after all, we're a wealthy country. But then the economy collapsed, and people would come to the meal not only to eat, but also to you know, share their distress at what was happening to Iceland. Eventually, those conversations, and partially encouraged by, they have like brought out a suitcase full of literature that you could read. And they made all these signs about capitalism and exploitation and food waste and stuff. So then that conversation built up to one Saturday. They said, "Let's march on the Parliament building. We've got to do something about this." And about 20, 30 people, after they're done eating, marched to the Parliament building. Well, that ended up making the news. More people came to eat the next week. The same thing happened. They marched, and eventually the march got so big that the government actually resigned. And all these events occurred. For even the local media, it was very, very funny article by The Weekly that's published in Reykjavik, saying they were hoping Food Not Bombs would bring Homes Not Jails to the country, so there'd be another attraction that would bring people to save their economy because of how things were going. And they've been and that's just one of the examples of the conversation actually leading to some type of protest that then ultimately changes the society. And so most recently, Food Not Bombs has been in Iceland, has been advocating from the meal and after the meal marches to Parliament that there's a vote that just happened to not pay back the banks that have looted the country. And so this is the first country to refuse to bail out the banks as a result of those policies.
I think it's important to note that the entire nation of Iceland has less than 500,000 people living there. It's
right.
Smaller than Albuquerque.
Yep.
And there's something about that small scale which I think is important. Food Not Bombs has kept itself small scale and grassroots, but it seems like it's more likely to have a productive conversation in a really small country than in the United States. I don't know if that's true.
Well, I mean, the other thing is that we've been, you know, there's a couple of philosophies that I have that I think are reflected in Food Not Bombs, that to do something a long time over and over again has a big impact. So, for instance, we've been advocating the idea of doing an occupation in a decentralized way for many, many years. I participated in a meeting in Cancun. You know, we were very involved in helping promote and organize the first action in Seattle in 99 against the World Trade Organization and their policies. And we're trying to link the environment, poverty, labor issues, all the things that we now see are a crisis because of the policies of the World Trade Organization. And so there was another round of another summit in Cancun, and Food Not Bombs activists from all over Mexico got together, and we went to those protests. And we are feeling really disheartened that there are these big actions like this that weren't seeming to achieve anything. The police could absorb them, the media could absorb them, and it would just be these one-off events. So we actually met and discussed, we need a strategy of occupations that are decentralized, and they're all over the country and all over the world, all simultaneously, so that it builds and that people can come to them they'll know where to find like-minded people. And we had already participated in an occupation in a couple of places that were pretty effective. One was in the Ukraine, where Food Not Bombs was involved in providing the food for 100 days at the Orange Revolution. And I did a 27-day one with a group of homeless people in front of City Hall in San Francisco in 89 that was super effective and really caused a lot of efforts by the city government to try to change their policies on homelessness. And so, you know, there then became discussions amongst the Food Not Bombs community at all these little meals all over the world that maybe we should move into a direction of having occupations.
So you guys are the ones who came up with occupying? Or was it a coincidence?
Well, I think it was the time that I published a website on occupations and why they're important and effective, back in about right after the Cancun action, so about 2004. And it's still up. It's consensus.net, tentcity.html.
I mean, that's why I was saying at the beginning of the show that your book is prescient, because the stuff that's happening from Occupy Wall Street to Occupy practically everywhere in the world, you were talking about, what, 7 years ago?
7 years ago, yeah. And what's and one of the, you may, an interesting thing about the occupations is, and I don't know how much Food Not Bombs had an influence in the although a lot of Food Not Bombs people showed up to Occupy Wall Street on the 17th of September, and we had food at that. Of course, a component to an occupation is to have a kitchen and have food. You know, that's absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
You can't do it. So we're in a perfect position for that. But, you know, Food Not Bombs has three principles, that the food is always free and vegan or vegetarian. It's free to anyone without restriction. We have no leaders where each chapter is autonomous, and we use a process called consensus to make decisions. That's something we've been practicing for 30 years, trying to perfect in our little groups. You see that reflected in the occupations, that the decision making is non-hierarchical. They use consensus at the general assemblies. So that is something very familiar to Food Not Bombs community. And then also that we're dedicated to nonviolent direct action, that we're not a charity, but that we're trying to change society so no one has to stand in line to eat at a soup kitchen. That is also a focus of the Wall Street actions, right? Is that why do we have, with so much wealth, all these people struggling? And in new studies based on the census in the last months show that half of all Americans are struggling just to survive. So, you know, there is this definite, and a very strange thing that I didn't even realize until I gave my first copy of the book, Hungry for Peace, to Susie from New York City Food Not Bombs, said, "Oh, Keith, you've got to put your book in the library." I didn't even know Occupy Wall Street had a library. So she grabbed up some copies off my table and ran and put them in the library, and I was like so honored. But then somebody pointed out, "Look, you have a section in there on how to organize an occupation," and I go, "Oh, I totally spaced that out because I worked on that book for 3 years." So. That's kind of funny.
We're talking to Keith McHenry about his book, Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. Let's talk for a moment about food waste, food policy, the food supply worldwide. I mean, when you started, as we just talked about, there was so much food waste. There still is. How much food do we produce and then throw away, and why?
Yeah, okay, right. According to several different studies, which I've linked on foodnotbombs.net, actually, because they're really interesting. We actually discard 40% of the food that is produced in the United States before it gets to a person's table. So that is really astounding.
You're talking about the United States.
In the United States. And there was another study recently done that showed that if all the food that was thrown away every day by both Great Britain and the United States was actually recovered, it could feed the 1 billion people that go hungry every day.
Now, 1 billion people is a heck of a lot of people. That number has jumped very, very much just in the last few years.
Correct. It is. In fact, I have this one flyer that I've made early on when we started that says that, and you know, started out with like 10,000 people die because of lack of food every day. Now I've had to update that flyer over and over again, so now it's 25,000. And the other thing that's astounding, you know, when we first started, people were assuming we were collecting food and mailing it to Africa or something, right? But the reality was that there's hunger wherever we are. So we do have groups in Africa, but it's Africans that are feeding Africans. And there's actually, surprisingly enough, I've been to Kenya recently. They were discarding food in Kenya, yet there's a famine in Kenya. It's outrageous. But it's just the nature that food is a perishable item. And a more difficult thing to achieve is refrigeration and storage. And I actually also was in Ethiopia, and I met with these activists there. The Food Not Bombs kids, one of the things they were doing was growing mushrooms, that whole mushroom operation happening. The other, they were working with a community group to dehydrate potatoes because they grow lots of potatoes, but they'll be like, and so on a year when there is water and they can grow potatoes, they have lots of potatoes, but then there'll be 4 years with no food, and if they had dried potatoes, they would have protein for people. So that was something they were working on. So a lot of times, but then another tragic thing, for instance, in Somalia, a lot of the large transnational grocery chains grow food in Somalia to this day. So you have a famine, with people living outside of these huge vegetable farms, starving to death, and then the produce is being packed up and shipped by plane to Europe instead. And even for all the famines in Eastern Africa, this has always been the case, where you have for almost every ton of food aid delivered to Somalia, 3 tons of fresh produce is exported to Europe and to Australia and the United States.
Nobody knows this.
No. And this is, you see this even within America, where you have people starving to death becoming very, very malnourished. There's a book recently I read called The End of Food. And it points out that the large Americans are people. Americans are really large. They're starving to death while they are
obese,
and that's because we have farmed the nutrients out of our soil. And I think often people say, "Oh, we need to turn to genetically engineered foods." But I think genetically, my research in writing this book, and a lot of which I didn't end up putting in the book because there's so much, was how genetically engineered foods are one of the leading causes of world hunger right now.
How is that? Because there are people who make the argument that genetically modified foods, because they have higher crop yields or whatever the thing is, can solve world hunger.
Well, it turns out what happens is, and it's pretty logical when you think about it, you have to buy the seeds, the activator genes, the all of those things every season. And if you've been a farmer, and I know myself, I garden. I have like pretty extensive gardens in Taos over the years. If you save the seeds from that year's harvest, your next crops for the next season are much stronger and much produce a lot more. And you don't have to buy the seeds. You collected them for free. And farmers for centuries have been doing that, saving their seeds. But Monsanto, which now controls roughly 90% of all food seeds, they are now making it required that you buy them every season. So you have farmers that have to take out huge loans to buy the seeds, to buy the chemicals, and they can't, as a result, the expense of actually growing food has gone out of sight. And literally thousands and thousands of farmers around the world have gone out of business because they can't afford to continue to buy the seeds from Monsanto year after year, whereas they survived for generations before because they harvest their own seeds and they did not have that issue.
We're talking to Keith McHenry about his book, Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. We were just talking about genetically engineered foods and how much more hunger there is than there was just a few years ago because of the international economic situation. There's also the factor of climate change that needs to be factored in here.
Right. There's there's been, in 2007, there was a really major confluence of crises, one of which was climate change. And I know if anybody that's trying to grow food up here in northern New Mexico finds that our season has gotten shorter, and it's been quite a crisis. And one of the ideas about Food Not Bombs, encouraging a plant-based diet, because our foods are all vegetarian and vegan, was initially influenced by Francis Moore-Lapay's Diet for a Small Planet, but it's now become even more urgent, and we've seen with the United Nations that they're urging, as the second largest cause of climate change gases is through food production. But it also, on the other side, it was also part of a food disaster. So you saw, for instance, a drought in Russia, which became a whole political crisis over wheat because they would not export wheat because they didn't have enough wheat for their own country. This was directly due to climate change. You also have these major floods, some which are not even in the news. For instance, there was the Mekong Delta, wiped out literally hundreds of thousands of acres of rice and affected rice production worldwide. We heard at that same year, of course, the catastrophe in Pakistan. And so we see that food production is being adversely affected by climate change, increasing prices. We also have the problem of edible foods being used for ethanol, which has driven up corn prices. And there's a link between Monsanto and corn and ethanol, too, because the corn actually that's being grown by Monsanto, Monsanto seeds isn't like what you go and get out of a can or go buy in your corn. It's actually used for meat production. So there's that, those links. And then you had the other big problem. At the beginning of the occupation, the first occupation I participated in this wave of occupations was actually Chicago, outside the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And one of the core organizers of that occupation was a trader from inside. And she had astounding stories to tell about corruption and commodities trading.
Really?
And what we can see is in 2007, Monsanto doubled the price of its food seeds. That, of course, and also their activator chemicals and so on. You have all this harsh weather that is occurring globally. And because the housing market is collapsing, people are starting to invest in food instead of in housing. And that's driving food prices up. So you see this huge spike in food costs and in food shortages in 2008. And then countries like Egypt and Tunisia, which are subsidizing food, you know, their wheat and everything to their communities, are now facing economic pressure to raise their prices. And so for a person that is living on a dollar a day, a 50-cent increase in their daily food costs is enough to wipe them out completely. And you start to see there was over 48 major countries had riots in 2008. And we're now seeing that confluence again of events of speculation in food, of more crisis in climate causing food scarcity, even at the time when there should be overproduction. And then we're also seeing the manipulation of food prices by companies like Monsanto. So all those things are happening again, and many, many people point to the issue of food and hunger as the spark that started the Arab Spring, which has now went to Madison, Wisconsin, as the struggle there with Scott Walker and the first occupation there, Walkerville. Now to what's really a global, even as we speak now, I'm getting news from Food Not Bombs kids in Russia about their participation in the uprising against Putin and the stolen election that just occurred. So all of these things are totally interrelated, and I feel really honored to be having, one, work with Food Not Bombs at a time where food is, becoming core to the political struggle worldwide, but also that we're offering a lot of solutions. So beyond just recovering food, which is what we're most famous for, we also have other programs like Food Not Lawns, reclaiming
food not lawns.
Food Not Lawns.
Yeah. So basically, you take your lawn and convert it into a garden.
A garden, correct. Yeah. Or another thing is like the way the occupations are, you're reclaiming public space. Now, not all public space is just sidewalks and concrete, but there has been a whole campaign of Food Not Bombs recovering vacant lots and inviting their neighbors to come out and garden them and teaching organic gardening. The woman, Heather Flores, who coined the name Food Not Lawns, had gone to the School of Social Ecology studying permaculture in Vermont, coincidentally about 10, 15 years after I had gone to the same school to study organic gardening. So another aspect of Food Not Bombs is Homes Not Jails. And we started that with the savings and loan crisis, where there's all these abandoned buildings in San Francisco, people that were living literally on the sidewalk outside of empty, million-dollar homes, and yet the homes were, just falling in disrepair. And we started a campaign of opening the houses up. If there was a lawsuit between banks over the mortgage, we would take access to the building and move homeless families in. And often they could live as long as 2 years in these buildings before the legal cases would be resolved. And that gave an opportunity for homeless people to have some stability, to not suffer living on the streets, and to get their lives together.
It seems like there's a kind of similar syndrome if you took all the food that was being wasted and fed people, you'd have no hunger. If you took all the houses and apartments that were uninhabited and put homeless people in them, you'd have no homelessness. It's like
Correct.
The same thing.
What's a strange thing, if you go, like now there's websites about number of foreclosures in a city. If you take the number of foreclosures in a city and then also look at the data of the number of homeless people in that city, it's almost one-to-one. So, for instance, I just spent the summer in Orlando, Florida, where they made a large group feeding law to keep us from, they're trying to drive the hungry and homeless out of Orlando, or at least to the ghetto where no one would see them. And in my research to write flyers and to talk to people about why we were being arrested in Orlando, I discovered that there was exactly the same number of foreclosed homes in Orlando as there were homeless people in Orlando. So, you know, there's probably no coincidence that those numbers are the same. And then just to let those homes deteriorate and go to ruin, and it's just outrageous. So there's all these connections. Another thing that I've noticed in traveling, because I've visited Food Not Bombs and all over the world, if you go,
I just love that there's Food Not Bombs all over the world.
It is really crazy, isn't it? And if I show up, sometimes I'll come to a city, and I end up seeing the Food Not Bombs logo glued on light poles and stuff, and I go, I didn't know there was a Food Not Bombs in this country. That's
right.
Crazy. But when you're in Western Europe, up until recently, you would notice that there are very small numbers of homeless people. And part of what I noticed in every country where you had universal health care, you had very small numbers of homeless. And I think there's a direct correlation there as well. If we had universal health care in the United States, that would diminish the amount of people living on the streets dramatically. And so all these kinds of – that's been part of the idea of Food Not Bombs was to – we always had like a literature table with the food. We tried to show by example that we're nonviolent by having vegetarian and vegan food, so nonviolence against animals as well. Trying to show the links between the environment and hunger and poverty, between economic systems and political systems, and how things are dissolving. And, you know, Food Not Bombs is what's amazing to me, which had never occurred to me when I was a young person helping start this, was that it would work out that, you know, there's pictures in the book of the Bangkok Food Not Bombs kids, you know, and they're obviously Muslim people that are cooking food and sharing it in Bangkok, Thailand. And it's not like that it had to be in a Christian country. It didn't have to be there's 20 groups active in Sweden and in Finland, in Finland, and another like five or six in Sweden. Those are very wealthy countries, yet they have very active Food Not Bombs chapters.
Because they still have hunger there?
It's not that. It's the it's an effort.
It's the Not Bombs part?
It's the Not Bombs part and the consumerism part and the waste of food and the whole opulence that's happening. From their perspective, the food issue is more in Africa. So here they have all these resources, and they know they're deriving it from places like Africa and Latin America, and that they couldn't be so wealthy if they were not poor people that they were depending upon in these other nations.
We're talking to Keith McHenry about his book, Hungry for Peace. One thing that I find so both heinous and perplexing is that Food Not Bombs has been the target of police actions almost everywhere that it goes. So you guys basically show up with a message of peace, nonviolence, and feeding the hungry, and then the police in all these different cities try to shut you down, take away your literature, kick you out, arrest you, and things like that. What is going on?
Well, what we've found, we have the first arrests were in August 15th of 88 in San Francisco. And they made 9 arrests that day, but they, by the end of, in 4 weeks, they made a total of 94 arrests. And the police,
for what?
And what they what the police said was that they didn't mind us feeding the hungry as long as we were not doing it in public and that we were not allowed to make a political statement. They said that was not allowed. And in research,
so the First Amendment doesn't count?
They say that we can stand out there with flyers and signs saying there shouldn't be hunger, or we can have food, but you can't put two together because then that is not protected speech under the First Amendment.
And according to
Well, according to the city attorneys of San Francisco, according to other city attorneys in other cities, it turns out what has happened is that there's this pattern. It turns out military contractors will go to police departments and they will and to city officials, and they'll encourage them to shut us down. But it's embarrassing to overtly admit that their concern is that money will be diverted from military spending towards human needs if our message is taken to heart.
But that's the part that's perplexing, because the feds are the ones who are paying for military spending, not the cities. So why do they care about federal military spending?
It's the city governments don't actually care about it. I think that the police departments are provided some type of logic. And this is most recently the logic that I witnessed was that there was on C-SPAN, there was a lecture by two State Department officials comparing Food Not Bombs and Al-Qaeda.
Oh,
this was
goodness.
On broadcast on April 9th of 2010. And what they were saying was that that Al-Qaeda was a dead-end organization. It was going nowhere. People didn't want to join it. They were even dying, killing themselves in suicide bombings. And they didn't say the name Food Not Bombs, but they said the people serving the vegan and vegetarian food were actually a greater threat, because it was encouraging the public to think that money should be diverted from military spending towards education, healthcare, and things like that. And as a result, there wouldn't be enough weapons available to fight the enemy, of which one of the main enemies was Al-Qaeda, which, from their point of view in that lecture, was getting smaller and smaller in and of its own self. So that's the logic. We were originally declared America's most hardcore terrorist group in 1988, after the first 94 arrests, when
you're a bunch of vegan, non-violent,
yeah.
I mean, if I may say, I don't want to say the word hippies because that's been misused, but basically just like really down-to-earth people.
Yeah. In fact, in 1988, there were only at the time we were declared terrorists, there was a group in Boston, one in San Francisco, and one in Long Beach, California. There was like 30 or 40 Food Not Bombs volunteers. Yet the National Guard had workshops at units all across the United States, where they spent 3 days on Thanksgiving weekend of '88 discussing the threat that we posed to America. Where I'm still trying to get the documents from that, but I've heard reports. I just was in Pittsburgh, and an old friend of mine reminded me that he was approached by a National Guard's person who saw his button at the Pittsburgh airport that Thanksgiving and told him he studied Food Not Bombs and counterterrorism school and that it was the most hardcore terrorist group.
And here's one of the ironies. There was a big earthquake in San Francisco was it 89?
Yeah, the Loma Prieta earthquake in 89. We had been arrested for months every day sharing food. There was the first occupation. Basically what happened is there's an occupation called Tenement Square, organized by homeless people, that we fed for 27 days in front of City Hall. And it was for the human rights of homeless people. They organized it themselves. At the end of it, they cleared out the occupation, and the next thing they did was they started to they withdrew our permits and started arresting us for sharing food. So we had daily arrests through that whole time. We even started a program called Risk Arrest one day a month with Food Not Bombs, and we'd get church groups and others to come out and get jailed using the food that we provided. And then Loma Prieta happened. We had our food on the stove in Richmond District. The gas and electricity went off, so we took it down to City Hall thinking, wow, the cops will be real busy with this earthquake. We had more people than we ever could imagine show up. We were about maybe an hour late total getting the meal out because of this having to restart the kitchen in a field kitchen that we used for the occupation. And to our surprise, more cops than ever showed up. Usually it was just this one squad that got rid of us, but it seemed like the whole department. And they all stood in a line and waited
so
their turn
to eat.
And
so the same cops who were arresting you were the day before,
were
eating the meals.
Correct.
Did they learn anything from that?
Well, they did. It was very interesting. The police did. We ended up with very close relationship with the actual guys that arrested us. And I even had some pretty I was clubbed between the eyes at a protest by an officer in 93 and had two surgeries. I was ultimately beaten 13 times on the street publicly by either nightsticks or flashlights. And I was actually taken off the streets three times and taken to the police intelligence office, where they ripped my clothes off of me, lifted me by my arms and legs repeatedly until my ligaments and tendons ripped, and they put me in a stress position box naked for 3 days in each of these occasions. But nonetheless, because we're in this struggle day in and day out, those people, they realized who we were. They knew our families. They knew what was happening. That was the fact the police refused to continue their repression that ended what was ended up being 1,000 arrests in San Francisco. And we ended up being really good friends with people who were on the front lines attacking us because of this. They knew we're dedicated to nonviolence. We treated them with dignity and respect.
Even as they were clubbing you between the eyes.
Correct. And we have a video online you can see called Food Not Bombs Greatest Hits. There's an extended version that you can get from us that shows Van Jones as our legal observer. So that was an important lesson, which I do write about in the book, about the importance of nonviolent direct action, because we've also been infiltrated and accused of. We've had FBI agents or people paid by the FBI and Homeland Security join our movement, advocate violence, and then our volunteers be picked up for allegedly plotting violence that was actually plotted by the state. And so
So you can probably smell those people a mile away.
Oh, yes. It's pretty intense. There's definitely the woman that framed Eric McDavid. He's doing 20 years now. She was in a core group of people that helped organize a Food Not Bombs gathering in Philadelphia at in the week before a biotech conference. I had the weirdest feeling about her, and it turned out she was an informant, paid $65,000 a year to infiltrate.
I mean, one of the things that I think is tricky about consensus decision making is that if you have an infiltrator, they can ruin the whole process because they can block consensus.
Well, that's an interesting thing. We actually chose consensus as our way of making decisions because of infiltration. What had happened was I was in a group called Boston Alliance Against Registration of the Draft before I started Food Not Bombs, before I was in the collective that started that. And it turned out what the government was able to do was they hired the executive director of the organization was actually an agent. And so since it was through voting and had a hierarchy, it was able to be controlled by the government completely. And me and a friend of mine, Franco Flitto, we were eventually thrown out of the organization. And later on, through Freedom of Information Act requests and stuff, we found out that he and I were the last two non-informants in the organization.
Oh, my goodness.
So the treasurer was an informant, the president was an informant, the vice president. And there's a history of that. So while on the one hand you can have your process blocked by an informant, it dilutes the power of the FBI in the ability to disrupt.
And if you have consensus.
If you have consensus. And part of the thing, I think a lot of people misunderstand consensus. It's not an adversarial way of making decisions. It's a way of chumming to consensus to have everyone consent on the process. But you can see if a person is blocking over and over again, they are not sharing the same goals as the rest of the group. And it's that time for them to join the group that they feel better about. So whether they're an infiltrator or not, that's definitely something that has to happen.
We're talking to Keith McHenry about Food Not Bombs. The new book that you have out, Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs, is interesting because it's not only a history of Food Not Bombs and all the things that we've been talking about and analysis of the economic and military situation and all of that, but it's also a handbook for people who are doing community organizing, and we'll talk about that in a moment. There's something, you follow nonviolent principles and presumably there's some Gandhian influence in what you do.
Right, right.
And I went to a lecture the other night, and the person who was lecturing was talking about how he decided to read the works of Gandhi, which apparently are just hundreds of thousands of pages. Many of it has mostly to do with diet and that kind of thing.
Right, it does.
But one of the things that he drew from this, which I think is just fascinating and very, very important, is that political action is not necessarily to change people's minds, but rather to get them to act on what they already believe. And when I looked at your book and was thinking about that, everybody believes that it's right to feed the hungry and it's wrong to fight unnecessary wars, but how do you get them to act on it? And your book really is a handbook and an example of a movement which is doing just that.
Right. That's definitely one of the things about, I think I was speaking a little earlier about these lessons that we had learned. One is to do it a long time, do a simple thing a long time. And also the other thing is we really were involved in the DIY, the do-it-yourself movement at the very beginning. You know, we're bringing punk music into our movement. So part of our idea is people are really encouraged to be a part of Food Not Bombs. So that's the one aspect of consensus. Everybody that comes to eat at Food Not Bombs, walks past the table, can become a volunteer with Food Not Bombs, and through their experience of actually participating in whatever little way they might do, that has such a huge impact on them emotionally and personally. So while you have these abstract ideas, like you say, that everyone is for feeding people and no one really wants to have these crazy wars and stuff, but they're actually doing the physical sharing of food with people on the streets, of actually engaging in these conversations with random people who may have opposite points of view from yourself, and there's such an internalizing aspect of becoming involved in Food Not Bombs. And that way we're reaching people. That was our concern. We felt like at the beginning of Food Not Bombs that there was this peace movement. They said we were against nuclear war, we're against the Vietnam War, but we weren't like engaging regular people that didn't agree with us in these ideas, and to be talking to them and to be spending time with them. And by having the food, it slows things down. And it gives us an opportunity to really reach people and invite them to really consider and to become involved in seeking these solutions to war and poverty. And so the do-it-yourself aspect of it is really key.
And the book is full of recipes and how to make banners and just the most grassroots, basic kind of stuff that you can do on an extremely low budget.
Right, right. That was part of our idea, too. Everyone should be able to do this. In the book, I have all these, like, the book is 8.5 by 11 in size for a reason. That's so that you can just, if you don't have a computer, you can, and many people really don't, and particularly in Africa and Asia and stuff, you can just take the flyer out of there and put it on a copy machine and hand write in your own information of how to get a hold of you and print it out. It has information on how to do, we have food sanitation tips, how to do low tech, you know, the three bucket washing idea. The other thing I realized, I had an earlier book called Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community, which was, we sold 10,000 copies of that in English. We also sold 6,000 in Italian, 3,000 in French. We sold them in all these languages. But I learned over traveling that also I had these recipes in there that was American way of measuring out food.
Ah, right.
So I had to change that.
Right, right.
Also, my first book had all this stuff about the legal issues within the United States. Because we're now half the, there's 1,000 chapters roughly, 500 outside the U.S. and 500 in the United States, I had to take a look at the legal issues. The law is perceived in a different way outside the U.S. So I had to expand, like, the, you know, legal support efforts that are, ideas that are in there, food sanitation laws that they might be in other countries. I had to look at it. I tried to look at it from a point of view that if you were in any part of the world and you got this book, then you would be able to reproduce Food Not Bombs successfully in your community and have as much impact as possible.
Keith McHenry is the author of Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. He's one of the co-founders of Food Not Bombs. He's been doing it for 31 years. It's just great to have you back on the show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.